And I'm Katie Monson, and I received my doctorate at University of California, Santa Cruz. And then I got to keep teaching there. And so I'm a lecturer, and I'm a lecturer at UCSC. I teach in environmental studies. I teach classes in sustainability and freshwater ecology and agriculture and climate and hands-on agroecology. And so I feel so lucky. It's a beautiful campus in the Redwoods, overlooking Monterey Bay. We have a gorgeous farm on the campus and gardens, and there's one garden on campus that is like the secret garden. You don't even know. You drive past it, and then if you find this little gate in, it has over 100 varieties of apple trees, plus all this other abundance of food coming out of it. And so I just feel so lucky to teach in this diverse, beautiful place. Oh, yeah, and we can see Monterey Bay spread out below us. It's just, yeah, I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky to be there. And I'm lucky to be here, too. So this is the second year I've gotten to be on teaching faculty, and I'm really honored to be back. And so we went out to look for invertebrates in the creek on Thursday, and Monday we started with talking about agriculture, if we reframe agriculture instead of just a production model, but really thinking what else it can provide us, then that changes our relationship with it and kind of how we understand it. And so we're building back towards Monday and thinking about food waste is what I want to do today. And so, just so you know, I make my classes do this too all the time, and they get pretty used to it by the time they've had me two or three times. They're totally in the groove with it. But I make you talk to each other kind of a lot because I think you have a lot of important things to say, and that's how we learn too. And so we're going to start right away with a question, which just is, this is an easy one. So what is one of your favorite foods and why? What makes it important to you? We're going to start with that question. So you can be in groups of two or three, or if you feel like your whole table is right there and ready to talk, no, that's fine. So your favorite food, one of your favorite foods, and why? What makes it important to you? So what are some of the foods that were coming? What are some of the foods? You can just shout out some of the ones. Oranges. So I'm just going to put up some of the foods that came up.
Strawberries.
Tuna, strawberries. Oh, strawberries are my favorite. I can eat strawberries till I'm sick. So I have very few vices. This is
raspberries.
Raspberries.
Cherries.
Cherries. Is it summer? I'm just wondering.
Milk.
And what was that over there?
Mangoes.
This isn't what I said in my group, but I've changed my mind. Salmon.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
I do.
Eggplant.
I do too, but.
Eggplant.
I would be executed tomorrow and I had my final meal. I would.
You think of a tough
getting a few of them up there. Great. So I start with this because as we delve into this topic of food waste, I want to keep in mind these kind of favorite foods of ours. If we're going to change our food system all the way, and I think of a food system, I'll talk about this more in a little bit, but all the way from the seed to the plate and then the waste pieces that are associated with that. If we're going to change our food system, we'll be helped by coming to this from a place of joy, right? That we need to come from a place of joy and from our deep connection to this food that nurtures us and sustains us, and also that connects us with one another, right? We can already hear as we list these out and be like, oh yeah, me too. Oh, right, that's so good too. That this food isn't something to be really different if it was just a pill that we ingested every day. But it's much more than that with our meals and the dining hall and everything, right? It's this time of connection. All right, so here's your next job. So go back to, you can just pick one for your table. Go back to one of these foods and describe what it took to get that food to you. How does that food get from... Describe what it takes to get that food from where it originates to a table. How does that happen? So if there are multiple ingredients for most of these so far, this is a very healthy group. I love this. If it has multiple ingredients, see if you know where those are from. and if not the specific location, maybe kind of a general region that it would kind of be growing in.
I forgot to say pizza. That's a
horrible. Oh, yeah. Oh, pizza. There we go. So somebody can try pizza.
Somebody's brave.
That has a few ingredients, right? And generally, how is it in an orchard, or is it in an ocean, or is it in a field? Where is it, and how is it getting to you? So again, I'll just give you, like, it doesn't have to be perfect. Just about 3 minutes. You can use the paper to start mapping that out a little bit if you like. But how does it get from where it originates to you?
One.
All right, so we'll go around, just each group, just briefly tell which food you were looking at, and then maybe something that came up from that, from thinking about that. Do we want to start over here?
Okay, we chose mangoes.
Mangoes.
And, all right, growing in North Australia. We didn't know if you grew them here in Florida.
They grow more like Mexico.
Mexico.
Yeah.
Well, the same principle would apply. They need pickers, a truck to take it to the packing, then boxes and a truck to take it to further plane transport, probably.
Yeah.
To the airport, and then to the distributor, another truck, and then to the warehouse, by truck,
yep.
The supermarket, by truck, and displayed in the supermarket, and probably needs, you know, sort of advertising and things like that.
Yeah.
And we go in our car to pick it up.
We do.
And hopefully not put it in a plastic bag, but hopefully.
We'll just carry on.
Hopefully we bring our own.
I mean, in Australia, in South Australia, we have to take our own bags.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have plastic bags for veggies and things, but, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, right. And just for mangoes, right? And then what did this table?
And those were fresh mangoes.
And those were fresh mangoes, right?
Not the Trader Joe's frozen bags of mangoes.
Right, not those frozen bags. Come on in, wherever there's seats here and there. Yeah, go ahead and you can kind of join this
guy. We were talking about strawberries, and we agreed that the best strawberries are local grown, and if you only buy strawberries, two of us only buy strawberries from local grown, relatively local grown farmers markets or something.
Yeah.
But you can also get them at Costco, but where those often come from Mexico. And store-bought ones we decided are not as good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Robert was probably telling you, I think, right, that eating local in Santa Cruz, I mean, if you decide you're going to be a locavore and just eat within a 100-mile radius or something, it's so cheating to live in Santa Cruz, because we have fresh strawberries from about March to November. So I only buy local strawberries too, but it's just utterly cheating on my behalf. But it's okay, because they're my favorite food, and I live in the hotbed of strawberries. So anyhow, I'll stop talking about strawberries in moments. Yeah, but great. Yeah, so it's a relatively shorter distance than from, unless they're going through Costco or a store. In this group, what did you all talk about?
We were focusing on raspberries.
Ooh, raspberries.
And contrasting it a little bit, because they're wild here.
Mm.
Where I come from, it's only with very intense and careful commercial agriculture. But, we talked about land, water, labor, especially labor, since they're so tender and fragile.
Yeah, with every berry we eat, as opposed to, in the Central Valley of California, they call these, you know how they say this word when you're down in parts of California?
Almonds.
I heard it. They say almonds. Almonds. It's because to pick almonds, they have the trees. They lay big tarps under the trees when the nuts are ripe. They clamp. There's a tractor with a big clamp thing that clamps around the trunk of the tree, and then it shakes the tree, and the nuts fall on the tarp. And then they either lift up the tarps or they vacuum. I'm a little fuzzy on that last step to getting them into the truck. But they say then that the reason they call them almonds is because they shake the L out of the tree. So as opposed to growing almonds, every berry that you eat was handpicked by someone blueberries, raspberries, strawberries. Those were each individually picked off a bush or a...
blueberries and raspberries are probably more commercially picked by machine than hand-picked. Mm-hmm. Blueberries especially because they're really pretty resilient. You can pick them with a machine, and it's all based on the cost of the value of the berry. If raspberry prices are high, then it's worthwhile picking by hand. If the prices are low, they pick by machine, and they mostly all go into puree.
And then how do they, because I've only seen the ones grown down in my neck of the woods, which are like hoop house grown, highly valued ones that they're going out to like Japan as well as around here. So how do they do the machine? Is it like vacuum or?
No, it's the machine straddles the row, and it has fingers that actually vibrate similar to the palm trees. And then it has little plastic conveyors that as the berries fall on that, they're conveyed up, and they're like, raspberries, because they're so tender, most of the machine-picked raspberries end up as puree.
Yeah.
You know, if they're fresh frozen, then they're pretty much picked by hand. But blueberries, they're real tough, you know, so they can pick them by machine. But they don't do quite as good a job as hand pickers, so if the value of the blueberries are really high, then it's worthwhile to pick them by hand. But right now, the blueberry market is pretty depressed, so just all berries are blueberries, at least, are picked by machine today.
Except for like farmers market kind of small scale. Like
if a person has a small plot.
Yeah.
We had a berry grower that was leasing our place. He's from Canada, and he was trying to encourage my wife and I to plant 10 or 15 acres of blueberries. He says, that'll be enough to keep you guys, this was like probably 10 years ago, sustain you the rest of your life just working those berries. Well, that's when they were $5 or $6 a pound. Now they're about $2 a pound. So to be sustainable, you can't really afford hand labor to do that.
Yeah.
That's commercial berries. I don't know what you pay for by farmer's market or fresh market.
Much more than that, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And cranberries, they beat them with beaters. They fill the bogs with beaters, and then the berries float. So that, great, I'm going to have to go look up some videos of that so I can see how those are done. Oh, perfect, thank you. But I think strawberries are mostly hand.
Yeah, it's pretty, I don't think there is a strawberry picking machine out there.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And then what did your group end up talking about?
Salmon.
Oh, salmon, awesome.
Ooh.
And anything come up of interest in the salmon moving from...
What we talked about, you know, if you think you're just going down to the stream and catching a fish and taking it home and throwing it on a barbecue, that, you know, there isn't a whole lot involved in that. But when you get to where that salmon actually came from and what went through to get that salmon into that stream, there is quite a tale of it being hatchery raised and dropped above the dam typically and released and then going off the ocean to come back up and caught. And those that are used for reproduction. And so even though you're just catching on a stream, it's still a lot of travel that's happened in between the two.
Yeah.
We also talked about farm-raised salmon, which I think is probably a larger part of the market these days, and commercial fishermen are starving these days.
Yeah.
And the fact that you buy your salmon at Costco like I do, it's farm-raised in South America.
Yeah, it's going to have to be frozen and shipped. And... Mm-hmm. Great, excellent. So what I've been having you do is basically a brief version of, they call it an LCA, a life cycle analysis. And the LCA then is, we use these in sustainability studies, to try to capture some of what's coming out of a process or a product. What do we see? Where are especially greenhouse gas emissions? But what else is being lost from a system as we're growing something or raising something? Or people will apply it in all kinds of ways. I saw somebody talk about a great LCA about camping, and wow, really think about what goes into camping even. So there's all, you can apply it in lots of different ways, and so. I wanted to do this. I wanted to give you an example of an LCA in more detail. And so you may have noticed this. I don't know, maybe. But the Dancing Servant of Holden, you know, the Dancing Servant. And here, there's, as you know, surprising gift is in all of your rooms, right? When that came up the other night, when Travis said that up at the trivia night, my 7-year-old, we were back in our room, and she said, "Travis said there's a surprise gift for all of us in our room." This is it, a surprising gift. But you know, there's this. There's our. we'll take care of that in a second. The dancing servant of Holden, are one of our symbols up here, right? And so, it's my book. Keeps falling apart. Perfect. I'll just set this over here for now. So our dancing servant of Holden might as well be carrying toast, because it seems that we eat more toast up here per capita than anywhere else in the lower 48. I haven't done the math, but it's quite a lot. It's quite a lot of toast. But I also am really impressed at how patient we all are. I don't know if it's Lutherans or what, but we all just wait very patiently in line as the littlest child is slowly buttering the bread and applying whatever condiments, right? And so one of the condiments for toast here is peanut butter, right? There's the peanut butter out there. And they're even all the knives out there in the condiment are officially called the peanut butter knives. If you're putting stuff away in the kitchen, you put away all the peanut butter knives. And so I want to show you what it takes to get peanut butter to the consumer, and even just a little bit of waste beyond that. So just a quick, you get 1 minute to think about this. What do you already know about peanut butter production, and what steps are there? And then I'll show you. So you just get 1 minute to just jog your memory, see what you already know. So I hear a couple of things coming up. And I'll show you, I'll walk you through this for a little bit, because I think this is super interesting, and this is why the story of peanut butter is why food waste is so important to me. All right, so we're going to talk about, this is a study by McCarty, James McCarty and colleagues from the University of Arkansas. And it's looking at 1 kilogram, or 2.2 pounds, of peanut butter. So figuring out how much emissions, basically, are coming from producing 1 kilogram of peanut butter. Okay. And so the first step is we have to have a farm, right? We're going to do a farm. So we're going to break this into 6 steps, amazingly enough. 6 kind of, they call them subsystems. So the farm is going to be our first subsystem. So in the U.S., we have 1.1 million acres of peanuts. Who knew it was so many? It's in 10 states, but it's only 10% of the world's peanut butter on these 1.1 million acres. And about 32% of all the peanuts grown in this country go to peanut butter. So they're starting with looking at that. So it's about 660 billion kilograms of peanut butter in the U.S. each year.
Peanuts or peanut butter?
That's the peanut butter. So it's even more than that. So it'd be about 3 times that, right? To be the total production in the U.S. And that 660 billion kilograms of peanut butter is worth about $800 million in sales. So, and that would be kind of the farm gate sales, not at the store. All right, so to grow peanuts, you have to do a couple things. A few steps you have to take. You have to prepare your field. Oh, you have to drop your microphone. I'm getting taped to the easel. Okay. You prepare your field, and you plant, and you do all the things to take care of the crop. You cultivate, you're going to manage your weeds, you're going to manage your fertility, so how much nitrogen and phosphorus you need on the site, and you also need to harvest. And so I heard some guesses about what this was like, and peanuts grow underground. They're a legume, but they grow, the nuts themselves form underground. They're these little underground, it's somehow that has evolved, because it's actually the seed, because you can grow peanuts, I mean, they are the seeds, but that part of the reproduction has been moved underground. And so to do all of this, you're going to need some machinery.
So when you plant seeds, or do you plant already established plants?
No, you plant seeds that grow and then form the underground peanuts after flowering. Yeah, it's kind of amazing. I've seen them grown really once when I was visiting Duke University's farm. They have a patch of peanuts there.
So then there's also a process to get the seeds?
There is.
Back up the food chain.
Yeah, which is the same thing. You have to go through the whole thing, all of this, to get that, which is, I couldn't tell from their analysis how much of this they incorporated in that first step of getting the seed. That part wasn't clear. And you need fertilizer. And you need agrochemicals. So that would be primarily pesticides. And you need, because we have the fertilizer split out, and you need irrigation. Not in all of them. Let's see, what was the 35% of U.S. peanut crops are irrigated. So some of them. So to figure this all out for the average peanut butter, they would figure out all the components, what percent of the crop is under each of these components, and then average it out for the whole thing, assuming like all the peanuts came together and were mixed together and represented the whole United States. And they assumed that you'd be getting all of these things from about 40 kilometers or 64 miles. And that'd be round trip for getting your supplies from a regional distributor. But you always have to end up having to limit your LCAs somewhere. Because like, how far back are we going to go? Are we going to go into what it took to get the steel to make the tractors? And then what happened, like what were the machines that got the steel to get to the tractors and what went into those machines? So you have to just stop somewhere. It will never end, right? So these are all these things going in here. And so that's at the farm level. All these things happening at the farm level. I'm going to pull this off and go to the next part. So the next part in their chain is the buying point. So you've got your peanuts. And they're raw. And so when you get your peanuts out of the ground, they're going to have some dirt on them, and they're going to have a little bit of rocks in there as you've pulled them out and harvested them. And this is where the buying point is, where the peanuts from many farms are combined and prepared for their next steps. So they're receiving whole peanuts and getting them ready and getting them ready to go out as whole peanuts. They're getting dirty whole peanuts. They're going to have clean whole peanuts at the end of this step. So the next thing you do to do this, to get clean whole peanuts, so in their shell, you need to transport them from the farm. You need to dry them because they're damp coming out of the soil. You need to clean them. You need to get all that debris off. And you need to grade them. So what are the better quality ones and what are the lower quality ones? So sometimes those will go into different parts of the food chain. Just like you said with raspberries, right? If depending on price or depending on quality, foods will go in different directions down the food chain. And so to do this, you need electricity. And this is primarily natural gas. This is for running big electric fan dryers to dry out those peanuts. And you also need electricity for screening. Your nuts are going to be on screens. They're going to be shaken, and the debris is going to be coming out, and cleaning them and elevating them, so storing them in an elevator, and just for the office operations. So you need electricity to maintain the facility. And then you need fuel. And the fuel is primarily diesel that's going to be transport from the farm to this buying point. And then at the buying point for the heavy machinery that's involved. Alright. And there's more. So now we have clean whole peanuts. Next, what's going to have to happen? Here's your clue.
Sheller.
Yeah, you need to go to the sheller.
Now, aren't there also, in some parts of the country, aren't boiled peanuts kind of a big deal?
Yeah, right. So these, so this is, we're getting into peanut butter. So the, so the, some of these peanuts
Oh, they have to go through all this process before they're boiled.
Yeah.
I see.
Some of them now would just head that way, and these ones are headed this way. Yeah, exactly. And so we need to remove the shells. So to remove the shells, we need to store the peanuts until we're ready. And then we need to go get them out of the storage. And then we need to shell them, that whole process itself. And then we need to store the shelled peanuts. So from storage back into storage until, because we're going to be just combining and collecting as we go, right? And so this, again, requires electricity. And in this case, the electricity is running the shelling operation, and then this storage at this point is cold. So they're going to maintain, because the oils in those peanuts are going to start to break down if it's not cold, right? So electricity to maintain the storage and to run the shelling operation. And then you need some more fuel. You need some more diesel to transport the peanuts to the plant and then to the storage. You need to transport the rejected peanuts after they're cleaned somewhere. You need liquid propane for the forklift. They're using liquid propane in this case. Then also cleaners. There are some cleaners that are used in the process, at least for cleaning the facility. And then some, depending on the operation, there will also be some pesticides used to maintain the crop at this point. All right. Now they're shelled. Now you've got shelled peanuts ready to go. So what's going to be next on our way to the
roasted?
Yeah, exactly. They have to be roasted. And so there's a couple things that happen at once at the processor. All right. So at the processor, we need to transport them again. We need to blanch them. We obviously not me, right? This is royal. No, that's not even royal wheat. That's just, I'm inserting my, I don't know what that's called. Roast. We have to roast them. Then they have to be cool after they're roasted. And then they have to be milled into the peanut butter paste and packaged. And then we have one more round of storage. Whew. All right. Peanut butter seems so simple, doesn't it? And so this requires, again, guess what we need? Electricity. In this case, we need it for lots of operations there. We need the fuel, and the fuel is diesel for transporting the peanuts, and depending on what kind of peanut butter you get, for the oil that is coming in, for sugar that's coming in, for salt that's coming in, and for packaging material that's coming in. And then there's also natural gas to roast the peanuts. So the roasting process happens with natural gas. And then we need cleaners. We need some more pesticides. Again, it all depends on the type, right? And we need some packaging. And there are three levels of packaging. The first level, the primary, is the jar with a lid with a paper label. The second level is putting that all in the paper, the cardboard case, like you would see at Costco, right? And then the third is palletizing. I love that palletizing is a verb. I didn't know that before, but palletizing it. So three levels of packaging. And then there are the other ingredients. All right, we're almost there. We're getting there.
So what pesticides would be used at that point in the production?
This would probably be, I imagine this would be some rodenticides to keep rodents out of your system.
And how are those applied to?
Yeah, I don't know. The paper didn't say.
Probably not to the nut.
No.
The facility.
I'm actually a food scientist.
Oh, nice!
And I'm from the Northwest, so I don't know peanuts about peanuts. But I did have a professor who said that apparently peanuts are really vulnerable to aflatoxin mold.
Oh, that's true.
Which
that's
is really
right,
bad
right.
for you. And so they probably use some mold inhibitors along the way, because otherwise they'd lose the product. Plus, it's I mean, aflatoxins are way worse than pesticides.
Yeah.
In terms of bad things for your body.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like so cancer inducing, I think, right?
They're carcinogenic. Extreme. They're like one of the most carcinogenic substances. She wouldn't eat peanut butter, and she was a professor of food science.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's worse.
That's super interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. All right. So that probably sounds like that's probably what's being used. Okay. We're almost home, literally, right? Okay. So now it goes to retail because we got to get it from somewhere. So to sell it to the consumers, we need distribution from where it was before. We need some shelving. They said that on average it's 5 meters of shelf space. So you can think about linear shelf space, 5 meters in an average grocery store. And these require electricity. There's everything you need to do to maintain the store itself, right? And fuel. And these were really just for those operations at the store. And at this point, we have some physical waste coming off. We're losing the secondary and tertiary packaging. So the cardboard around the jars and the palletized materials. Whew. But they said that 90% of pallets are reused. So that's a bit of good news, I think. All right, and then finally, the consumer. Here we end up back home with our peanut butter, or up at Holden, using our peanut butter. So to get this, we need to have transportation. We've got to get it home from the store. There's the use component, actually eating the peanut butter. And then there's the municipal waste, which includes the recycling stream as part of it. And this, again, requires electricity, no surprise, and fuel. Whew. So the electricity in this case, anybody want to know what the main electricity use they were seeing in here? They figured this out.
Keeping it cold in your refrigerator.
Oh, that's one. I think they were mostly looking at kind of shelf-stable peanut butter in this case, because they didn't account for that in this one.
Making toast.
Yeah.
Oh, making toast.
Cleaning.
So they were looking at dishwasher use. And these are kind of fun numbers to play with, right? Like, how many dishes on average over the course of a year would a family be dirtying, and how many loads of in a whole year of a dishwasher would that be, or just from peanut butter? And then for fuel, too, they did that. They figured that the average peanut butter consumption per household is about 12.3 pounds per year. And there are 110 trips to the grocery store on average per year, at an average of 26 miles altogether, or a round trip, I guess. And then that this is 0.44% of their family's food budget is going to peanut butter. And so they figured out for 1 kilogram of peanut butter is 2.2 total miles of driving altogether over the year. And then the recycling, there's some plastic and some aluminum seals. Most of that's going to the landfill. 100% of the paper labels they figure are going to the landfill. The plastic jars themselves, they figured about 46% of those are getting recycled. And then about 20% of the peanut butter itself is lost. That it's, the 20% is wasted. Okay.
I took a composting class, and
yeah,
they discouraged people from putting peanut butter jars in your recycle bin. This was in Spokane, because they said they're such a pain to wash and clean out that the cost of recycling a jar that's had peanut butter in it far exceeds the value of the container.
Mm. Yeah.
Which I thought was really interesting. I never thought about peanut butter this much
but
before.
But if you wash your jars really well.
Yeah, but still, you're washing them and using your hot water.
Yeah.
I mean, think about how messy a peanut butter knife is. I mean, that's part of why it takes so much to wash them. Because they're gross. I mean, it sticks.
They're gross. And those plastic jars that they sell, you can't put in your dishwasher. They'll melt.
Right.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, but how, you said the paper around the jar goes to recycling?
No, to landfill.
Landfill, okay.
Yep, they assume that all goes to landfill.
Right.
And I was wondering why so many places are using the plastic. Is because it's lighter, and so it's lighter to transport, and that's why they're away from glass, because glass is a lot easier to clean.
It is. It's light, and it's inexpensive. It's inexpensive from the manufacturing side, because oil is inexpensive.
And a lot of
the plastic is inexpensive.
Pot their own plastic. They make, like, a lot of milk distributors make their own milk jugs on site.
Yeah.
It comes in pellets, and they blow their own containers right there. So a large peanut butter company probably does the same. Rather than ship empty jars, they make their own jars on paper, or at least very close to.
Speaking of recycling, now that we've all been trained to be great recyclers, there's this problem that there's no market for the materials that we're recycling, for many of the materials.
Yep, China has said, that's it, we're done with your waste. Well, parts of your waste. We'll take the most
valuable ones. The city of Seattle, Seattle Metro is now the scrap paper that we recycle. They are having to bundle that and ship it to a landfill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They tried storing it for a while, but it builds it. It accumulates pretty rapidly. They were storing it, hoping that the market value would go up, but it has not.
It doesn't. I live on Puget Sound, right above railroad tracks, and every day, at least twice a day, long trains come from Seattle, past and down to eastern Oregon with trash. And you know that I can tell which trains are trash. Because if I'm working in the bottom of my yard, I can smell the trash.
Yeah.
You know, they're different cars. And we have a lot of that kind of trash going from cities.
Yeah.
When I lived in the East, New York City trash all went to Southern Virginia.
Yeah.
And some of the poor counties in this country accept that because it's money.
Yeah.
It's income.
Yeah.
So that's just,
So I'm wondering, what could possibly account for a 20% waste of peanut butter?
Kids
have
at this point,
toast.
Yeah. Kids making
not
too much peanut butter.
Not scraping out the jars?
Well, one of the answers was kids making too much toast up
above. Oh.
And then not eating the last of their toast.
I had a problem getting peanut butter out of jars for a long time. It was the plastic jars, and they were kind of... I complained to somebody like Safeway. I think they've smoothed out the jars, but it still sticks a lot.
Yeah, so there's a little bit that way, but it's just we live in this food abundance and we don't see this, right? Until I read this paper, I really didn't know how many steps were involved in getting peanut butter to me, right? And if we don't see these and we don't know these, then it really... You know, it doesn't matter so much to let some of it go because it's easy. We don't know where it's coming from.
Most
we're
of the cost is not the
from
peanuts,
it.
Is it?
What was that?
Most of the cost is not the peanuts.
Right. Most of the cost is not the peanuts. Right.
Is that true of a lot of food we eat, probably
processed
food?
Yeah. Yeah. Most of it's not actually that item. And then if this waste, and as composters will know. So if this 20%, if this then is going to the landfill, because a few of us compost, but it's not widespread yet, right? And so if this is going to the landfill, what's happening is you have, instead of it breaking down by aerobic bacteria, if you know compost smells great, real compost smells really good, the aerobic bacteria are in there. They break everything down. I mean, it smells bad for a little while right at the start while you're putting in the raw ingredients. But finished compost smells great. The aerobic bacteria are in there. They're breathing in oxygen just like we do. They're breathing out carbon dioxide. They're breaking everything down, and it's good. It smells good. And if it goes into the landfill, it's covered up, and so there's no oxygen. So the anaerobic bacteria are the ones that live there. So you have anaerobic bacteria that are working on it. And I know what the anaerobic bacteria, they're not releasing carbon dioxide, they're releasing something else.
Methane.
Yeah, they're releasing methane. And methane is a shorter-lived greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, but it's more potent while it's there. So there's a great image. John Oliver, who has a news program, right? News, what's his?
A late night comic.
So he has this great image. He said he has this image of the United States with red, white, and blue methane fireworks coming out of our landfills. I can't play his entire... He has a food waste piece, which has a lot of great information, but he's John Oliver. He's a little bit off color, so I can't play his whole clip in class, but at least the very end where he's showing our mountains of food waste with the fireworks is pretty impressive.
He's very clever.
He's extremely clever. Yeah, so this is all coming just out of our peanut butter, right? So this team figured out that in the end, you get 1 kilogram of peanut butter, you're actually releasing 2.88 kilograms of carbon dioxide equivalent. That's the way we talk about it. It takes all the greenhouse gases and puts them in relation to each other and just says it's about this much carbon dioxide altogether. So we're actually producing more gas than the weight of the peanut. So can you imagine how much? That's a lot of gas to get that 1 kilogram of peanut butter to the table. Amazing, right? And when they went through and looked at all these steps and figured out, so that you have a chance to talk to each other for here, you get 1 minute. Try to figure out where the top three, I'll tell you the top five, but try to figure out where were the top 3 points for the, and I'll move this back so you can see it. Where were the top three emissions coming from? Where's the most carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases? Where in the process? Okay, ready? 1 minute. There you go. Right there. All right, you ready? You ready to see? Should I do them five backwards or one forwards? Do you want to know the fifth? Okay, all right, we'll work backwards. We'll go from fifth. Fifth is processor packaging. Right here. That's number five. All the packaging at the processor level, that's the fifth most emitting point of greenhouse gases. All right, number four is consumer electricity. Getting the peanut butter off your plate and your peanut butter knives and your child. And three is the retail electricity, keeping the stores running.
Yes, because it has to be always
cold. Yeah, even with that volume. Number two is the consumer transportation. Because, and this is, even though there's so much other transportation, this is because of, these are all, everything else is at economy of scale. We're talking about big volumes of peanuts everywhere else along the line, right? And this is all our little trips to the grocery store.
And one jar of peanut butter.
Well, but they're counting it as one part of a grocery load. So even dividing out, trying to figure out what percent of your daily load of groceries is your peanut butter. But even with all of that, it's the transportation from the store. It's just inefficient the way we do it right now. And then the number one is the processor electricity. The blanching, the roasting, the cooling, the milling, this is all a lot of work to make those happen. Whew. So there's all this energy going in producing and selling and consuming peanut butter, and that's just energy. Okay, one more. You get to talk to each other again. I told you I'd make you do this a lot, right? You had warning. What else isn't captured in this LCA? We're looking at greenhouse gas emissions right here, right? This is greenhouse gas emissions. What isn't captured? What other kinds of things What other kinds of things are being lost along the way, or what are being used? What other kinds of things are being used to get to the peanut butter, to be peanut butter? So from the farm to you. What else is going into that process?
The jar itself.
Yep, the jar itself. So we have the raw materials going into the jar. Yep. Anything? Do you want help with this one? Okay, water. Right? We're not even talking about the water for the irrigation, for the processor, for the cleaning them at this point. I don't know how the shelling is done, if it's dry shelling or what. I imagine because there's no drying process here, so it's probably kind of dry cracking going on. But there's water here and here, so we don't even see the water used to get the peanut butter to us. We also don't see the labor that's used as part of all of this, people's time and energy. This doesn't capture the greenhouse gas emissions, don't capture the soil erosion if we are losing soil, depending on how we're growing. 20% of peanuts are grown in strip tillage. Strip tillage is when in your field you are you're only tilling rows along here, and then I guess that's even... I have to remember how I draw strip tillage. But you're only tilling little rows. You don't plow your whole field. You just do strips. And then you plant in those strips. You apply your fertilizer in those strips. You apply your pesticides. There's a non-organic corn grower that I visited his farm in Minnesota, and he does this kind of strip tillage to grow corn and soy. He's not organic, but he has one of the most beautifully managed pieces of land that I've ever seen. It's gorgeous, and he's trying to make sure that every drop of water that falls on his land is cycled through his land before it leaves to go anywhere else.
Do you know what peanuts, if they're like, legumes are pretty good to alternate crops.
Yeah.
Are they good for the soil?
They are.
Are they alternating them usually with something else?
They are.
If they're a legume, they're nitrogen fixing,
yeah.
So
yeah.
They're actually putting nitrogen in the soil, so the next year they can plant a nitrogen using crop,
yep,
in that
corn
strip, and
yeah,
and peanuts in the other strip.
Yeah, so they're totally used in rotation. And then if people are doing this conventional tillage way, then even if they're fertilizer use is highly efficient. The grower that I saw in Minnesota told me that he's probably using tablespoons on an acre because you're not applying it to the whole place, you're applying it very precisely to where it's needed. You can't do it in all climates, and you can't do it with all crops, but 20% of it is being done this way with peanuts. So there's a little bit less of that. There's much less soil erosion this way because you're protecting the everywhere around it with just biomass. You're missing the biodiversity effects, right? The effects on other species out there aren't being captured in this. So there's all these other effects. Or what about species that are getting, animals that are getting run over, roadkills. I mean, there's all kinds of things that just getting it through this process, we don't capture that just with this. But there's so many impacts.
What about the waste byproduct? Like what happens to the shells?
Yeah.
Process for that too?
I don't know what peanut shells.
Yeah,
there's
I don't
no
know
nutrition left in them, right? I mean, mm-hmm. They'd make probably be pretty good in compost.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
They would mulch in the soil.
Mulch, yeah, they'd make good mulch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really interested in...
decompose very quickly.
Oh, they
is
decompose
right?
quickly?
No, they do not.
Oh, do not, because they have a lot of lignin in them, right? They're a lot of pretty fibrous.
Yeah, you have to really grind them.
But I'm also interested in things like that. Right now, too, when we have potting mix, we use vermiculite in there, and vermiculite is a mined substance that goes in there. And we also use peat moss. Peat moss is also mined, essentially. It's very slow. It's not quite as slow as fossil fuel, but it's really slowly regenerating peat moss. So there's some things like that that we put in potting soil to fluff it up and allow air and water to move well through it. And I'm wondering about things like that, if there are shells from processing that could be incorporated and kind of have the same ability to hold water and while staying kind of fluffy. And maybe, I have no idea if peanut shells would do that, but it seems like there's some really great points along here where we could find some reuse for things. Reuse of waste.
So I'm wondering how this, thinking of what I could put in my sandwich at lunchtime, and try to save the planet. I'm wondering how like a jar of strawberry jam might compare to
you'd have
CO2
to sit
production.
Down, you'd have to sit down and do the whole thing.
I wonder if you have just a guess of whether it might be more or less. Or
it's very similar, I would guess.
Similar?
Yeah, I mean, you'll have to, there's the cooking process, which is going to use a bunch of electricity here, right? And sugar's, you have a lot of sugar, and the sugar is coming from somewhere, and sugar cane production is a pretty big deal.
The cold storage from the farm and the packaging, and then the cold storage, because they would have to be refrigerated until it's canned or sealed.
Right.
It's exponential. For every ingredient that's in something, there are all the ingredients and components that go to making that thing.
If anybody wants, I can send you later. I figured out part of it, and then I used information on part of it. No, did I figure out the whole thing? Yeah, I think I did. I did it for yogurt with, like a jam substance in it, too. So, like, figured out where that all comes from. Yeah, it's pretty interesting where the processing points are, and then you get into like regional markets of fresh regional markets and fruit being shipped rapidly across the country, and there's so much that goes into all of this, right? And so when we were talking about all of this on Monday, I'm going to switch over to the whiteboard for a minute. What I was trying to talk about is that we that this all it if we think about our ecosystems, our agriculture, just as production systems, this is kind of the current model we have, right? These are production systems. We put in water, we put in fertility, whether it's organic or not, whether it's organic fertilizers or others. Some fertility gets in there. There's carbon dioxide going in. There's pesticides, and again, there's organic pesticides too. So pesticides are not... And sunlight, we put in these things. And then the way we treat this right now is we have like a magic black box. And then this comes to us as food. Yay! Right? I mean, I have no, this is one thing, right? I haven't done, I don't know this for jam, I don't know this for like tons of things, right? So, and then the food, we say, yum, and then it's great, or we don't like it, and we toss it for whatever reason. And I see this, I mean, I live in a condo, and the condo, all kinds of people put things in the dumpsters, and I'm always just, I found a 5-pound bag of organic carrots in the dumpster, and they were a little, they started to sprout their little root hairs, but I was like, I don't think they had been even opened yet. They were on top of the dumpster, so you can go ahead and judge whatever you like about the situation. But I took the carrots out of the dumpster because it was just like, this is so... Everything that went into getting these carrots, and then they're just... The whole 5 pounds is in the dumpster. It just was so wrong. So I cooked them. I cooked them in like 5 different ways and made carrot pennies and carrot soup and I don't even remember what I did a bunch of things. Oh, and pickled some. Because I wasn't just going to serve them raw, even though they were right on top and, you know, probably totally fine in the dumpster. But there's just, you know, a thing. It is the dumpster, so there's just that squeamishness, right? So probably a good, healthy squeamishness around the dumpster. But it was just like there's so much that goes into that, whereas if we don't think about where these are coming from and what's going into it, it's so easy to just be like, yeah, the carrots are hairy, so, and out they go. Yeah.
What? And I'm sure you probably heard that chefs who have gone to dumpsters and reclaimed all this food and then prepared these bagless meals all from the dumpsters. And I heard recently that in some orchardists and other, you know, big agricultural producers, that when the apples don't fit the size, like they either have to be the small lunch size or the big beautiful ones that are sold individually, whatever doesn't fit what's, you know, the going popular, they take it to the landfill. And the amount of produce, you know, fruits and vegetables that are taken, you know, to landfill is horrendous. and that's producing a lot of gases too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so we have the loss, some loss there that doesn't, it doesn't fit what the rest of the food system says it should be fitting into, right, for the next step. Then we have some, there's a little bit of loss in here, but I imagine this isn't too much along this way. And then this is really where, some is lost at retail. If it's over an expiration date, sure, no matter what it actually looks like, and then at the consumer level. Just because I haven't sat down and asked people, but I think it's really because we can't see this, right? Mm-hmm. That we just assume that this system is bringing us this food, and it's fine, and we're not as connected. We're not as connected to it anymore. And so,
one of the things, mm-hmm, I volunteer at a food bank every Tuesday morning, and a lot of the food that we get is expired from Trader Joe's, Safeway, Lucky, other Raley's grocery stores. And it's very interesting. Some of the clients who are going through will actually look at the expiration date.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And if it is too old, they won't take it.
And they shouldn't.
You know, this is,
we're not allowed,
good
in our food
food
bank, we're not allowed to take expired food.
No.
You know, people sort it and get rid of it.
We don't pass out expired at the one I work at.
Well, this is like, I usually work on, you know, specialty bread, so it might be a loaf of a baguette or something, mm-hmm, and the date will be like, you know, well, I just was there like the 20 something of June, and it might have been, it said the 24th of June, it might have said the 23rd of June. I mean, they can't sell it anymore, but if you had bought it yesterday, it would have been perfectly
sure.
Best if used
right.
by.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that it all of a sudden is poison after that date.
Right.
I think our food bank, they have a limit, isn't it? Like a couple weeks or a month or something like that. That is, they won't take it beyond that. They will take it. Sorry.
And there's not standardization across these labels. Best if used by is something that the manufacturer puts on there and is their
marketing, maybe.
Yeah, it's part of marketing. And then even expiration dates are not consistent across the board. So that's like some place where maybe legislation around that language, as well as consumer education around that language, might help. I had a friend whose mom, every time a milk in their house hit the expiration date, even if it was fine in the fridge, she would toss the milk because that was... She trusted, we're putting our trust in this food system, right? And so you're going to trust that if that says expired by it, that that's really what that means. But if there's not consistent language around it, then I don't know how to judge, like, what the bacterial level in my milk is right now, right? I'm just going to go by the smell, right? That's how I judge.
So we waste 20% of our peanut butter. How much, is there a percentage figure of overall what we waste?
Well, that is an excellent question. Right?
And
are you a plant?
Totally a plant. All right, so we, right now in the U.S., we're wasting about 15.5 million tons of food a year. Or it's about $166 billion. It's kind of interesting to think about, right? It's like if you... That's everybody's money. It's just like... Whew.
So is that... That's post-consumer, that's after you buy it from the store. That's not what the producer is throwing away.
This is the whole food system. This is the whole, all along this process. But I'll get it there too.
How many dollars is it?
$166
billion.
Billion
or million?
Billion. It's for this many million.
Is it 40%?
Yeah, it's somewhere between 35 and 40%. And it varies by product. So if you look at, if you just take meat, poultry, fish, that's, we waste about 41% of fresh meat, poultry, fish. Of fruits and vegetables, we waste about 17%. And of dairy, it's about 14%. So of all the food waste along the way, about 72% is from fresh food. And now the American diet is maybe about 70% commercially processed foods. We eat a lot of commercially processed foods.
Wow.
And so what the way that this looks at this, where we lose food along the food chain is different in different places. So in lower income countries, it's about 25% from loss to microbes along the in the early parts of the food chain. So about 25%, and it's really due to on farms and in storage and distribution. And in higher income countries, like us, and sorry, Australia's in there too, New Zealand, Europe, industrialized Asia, Canada, so no smug Canadians, they're in our mix too, that really it's about 35% to 35 to 40%. And this loss is, it is really, it's more unintentional. It's more loss to aesthetics, and overpurchasing. That we have, along the way, we've lost the art of kitchen efficiency, somebody was talking about. How people ahead of, people before us were really good at using everything. I mean, the way we got French toast is, in French, is I can't pronounce, there's a lot of language I can't pronounce. I tell my students that so they feel like I'm butchering languages equally. Pan perdu, right? So it's, which is lost bread. It's the lost bread that you're turning into French toast. So it's the bread that was too old, right? So I actually take the communion bread from church, from our church, and turn it into, I hope this isn't sacrilegious, and I turn it into French toast at our house all the time. So it's that converting that lost bread. Oh, you have to have a look. Yeah, you have back me. And then there's also some, just like you were saying, there's some lost at the farm gate. If the price is too low, if the price of for the food is too low, the farmers can't afford to pick anymore. So we can see that. We'll see that in the fields near where I live. We'll see lettuces left in the field or broccoli left in the field if the price is too low and the plant is just past its prime, right? If there was something that happened, then it's left. So that, to me, is like the least offensive waste because then it is plowed back into the soil. It's at least going back into the system and it's carbon going into the soil. That's like, that's not the worst thing, although it's lost income for the farmer, too.
And so the farmer has already put out all those expenses to get to that point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The one thing they don't want to do is pour more money in for labor
yeah.
to harvest.
And like we were talking about on Monday, just the difficulty of getting labor in some parts right now with the with migration law, right? Mm-hmm. So how difficult that is, right? And so you're going to lose it at that point. So we're at this point where now the largest component, and the reason you can smell those trains going by, is food waste is the second largest component of municipal solid waste in the U.S. So the biggest part of our solid waste is food waste. And it's second to paper, but paper gets a lot more recycling. And only 3% of food waste isn't landfill or incinerator bound. So only 3% goes into some kind of composting or some sort of system. And so it's really because paper, even though there's more paper put out, the paper gets recycled more, so it ends up being the largest component of what's headed to the landfills or to incineration, depending on the municipality.
We have large-scale composting in Spokane, and I don't know what percentage of it is, But is it economically feasible relative to, it costs something to compost too.
It does. It does because you are using large scale equipment this is done.
It's not
huge operation.
It's not like here. The Holden composting is wonderful.
Yeah.
But the commercial composting is
Yeah, I saw, but I haven't read yet, a paper on it.
Okay.
Yeah, somebody was looking at that.
Yeah, yeah.
I can get that get that if you're interested in it. Yeah.
We have commercial composting too. We have our green bin.
Yeah.
And all our poop, kitchen waste and outside waste goes into it.
Yeah.
And we used to be able to go and pick up the compost at the, to use in your garden, but they've stopped doing that.
So what's it? Ours is sold.
Alameda, California. Yeah. It's outside.
Yes,
a lot of the Bay Area is going to.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because Santa Cruz, which is a fairly environmentally friendly little city, does not have that yet on a city scale. But we have a couple alternatives. One of those is there's a woman named Ivy who has a bike. This, I think, is the second most friendly to Holden's on-site, right? She has a bike, and she comes with a bin, and she dumps your compost for the week. You have set it outside in a bucket. She dumps your compost. She actually weighs it first. She weighs your compost for you. She dumps it in a bin, and she bikes it down to the Homeless Garden Project, which is where homelessness learn food production skills. And she composts it there. And then based on how much you put out each week, you build up points. I have a huge number of points right now. And with your points, you can get compost back. You can get $5 off at the tea shop downtown. You can get a free native plant. If you go out to the native plant nursery, she'll give you iris starts from her house. There's all kinds of things you can get with your points. And it's really cool because she keeps telling you, like, each month, all together now, we've composted as much as a blue whale, or she'll, like, she's, like, building it up. And you personally are composting 126% above average or whatever, so you can watch your numbers. But it's only $5 a week for a bucket. But I think this is, like, probably as we think about taking back our food system, we have a really highly efficient food system. And some parts of it are going to need to stay at this kind of efficiency, and some parts are probably also going to need to be more localized, including dealing with the waste. And so Ivy's got this really highly localized, community-connected food waste management, and she's making a living off of it, right? So I think it's a really beautiful example. And she's strong as heck from biking up and down the hills in Santa Cruz. She's tough. Ivy is tough. But, we also don't have there's this thing called winter I hear of. I don't know what that means, but we don't have it. It gets 50 in the winter sometimes on the cold days. So with all of this, this book is Drawdown. I really like this book. We didn't even plan this, but Barbara, also on the teaching faculty, this was one of her recommended books this week, just by mutual affection for it, I guess. And this is by Paul Hawken of Smith & Hawken, the gardening supply company. He's gone on to do a lot of other really great work aside from that, and so he was looking at, they took all these potential solutions to getting carbon dioxide back, getting carbon back in the ground, getting it out of our atmosphere and back in the ground. And so they looked at everything, walkable cities and heat pumps and coastal wetlands and all kinds of things. And the number three, and then they ranked them all, they ranked the top 100. And of the top 100, reducing food waste is number three. Because they came up with, they said it's with through their calculations and other calculations that globally wasted food is 8% of all our greenhouse gas emissions. They're anthropogenic. So 8%. So that's a big thing. So he says that if you thought of it as a country, if food waste was its own nation, then the greenhouse gas emissions would be highest in the U.S., and then China, and then the land of food waste. So it's on par with an entire nation. And in their total analysis, reducing food waste by half by 2050 would save 26.2 gigatons of carbon dioxide equivalent. Plus, not only would you save it, you would be if we reduce how much we're needing on this end. If we reduce all the way back through, then we are also preventing we're preventing deforestation that we would need for additional farmland. So that's going to save us another 44 gigatons of carbon dioxide. So to them, this is so important. Isn't that amazing? Number three, it goes refrigerants, wind turbines, food waste. So it blew me away when I saw that. And so if we can kind of convert how we think about agroecosystems, so this is tying back again to Monday. And if we can take them out of this magic black box, but there they are, there's the food system, and we remember that this is going into a truck. Don't judge my drawing, or judge it if you like, but else I don't care. And that there's processors along the way, and then there's some little grocery store. There's a fabulous little natural foods grocery store, but you could have it be, it could be a sunny day at Costco or whatever you like. And then getting it home and onto the table. That is not a great table, but there it is. These are flowers on the table. So putting it at the table, if we remember that it's not just this kind of one-way magic thing getting food to us, but that really it's a whole system, right? Maybe that would help us understand it a little better and really think about how we can conserve it at these different points. And especially in the higher income countries, really how we can reduce it, especially on our end, because here these were the biggest losses, right? The losses of greenhouse gas emissions were here and here. And ready to talk to each other one more time in our last few minutes. So what are some strategies? You just get 2 minutes. What are some strategies that you've already heard about? And we can kind of map a couple of them out, and I'll tell you about a couple of cool things that I know about so far. But what do we need to do? What do we need to do to reduce food waste along this way? Ready? Jen, I said just 2 minutes. I'm going to watch. Ready? Let's before we're done. We'll point out a couple of things along the way. So one is that we can still work with these lower income countries. So one of the things that we might want to consider putting, instead of sending them corn, right, one of the things that they maybe could use would be like assistance with infrastructure. So helping them have adequate roads and helping them have, helping other countries have adequate storage facilities. And in that report, they're saying even just better bags and crates and boxes, just simple things, would really help with cutting down on some of the loss in lower income countries. And then for us, it's a lot is dealing with this overpurchasing and aesthetics. I heard about the ugly fruits and vegetables, right? Some people are really working with that. And then some of the authors I've been reading, they really try to point out it's going to be hard to mobilize everybody in the U.S. We're a very independent lot, right? I don't know what Australians are like overall, but in the U.S., we consider ourselves fairly independent types, right? So that really some legislation might be needed at some points to really help push this forward. Like legislation helping standardize packaging and best used by and sell by and expiration days. That would really help push that forward. Do some consumer education as part of that. But also France, for example, in 2013, made it illegal for stores to throw away their leftover foods. It needs to go to charity or to animal feed or to composting companies. But they're not allowed to throw it in dumpsters anymore to reduce that food waste. Oh. I mean, it's really cool. On our UCSC campus, UCSC before it was the university, it has a logging history, logging and lime production for San Francisco. And down by the entrance to campus, there's a conical structure that looks like this. It's this big thing. It's probably about this high. It has this big cone in the middle. And it's right by the cookhouse. It's where the cook would put the food scraps for the pigs every day. They'd dump the bucket on top, and the pigs would come and eat it. So that cement structure is still there on our campus. And so a lot of this food could be cycled back into the food system that way too, for animal feed in appropriate ways. And so really that a couple of scholars from Delaware were also suggesting things like innovations in packaging, like nanofibers that would change color depending on spoilage levels in bags. So that's, we have to really kind of weigh that. Then we have nanofibers, and we're not really sure what the result, what's going to happen with those yet. So I don't know about that. But maybe, depending on how those costs and benefits when it come, how they come out in the wash, I guess. And it really kind of at the heart of all these is there's this personal gain that the legislation around farming, that the 2014 Farm Bill that Senator Grassley put out there, that 70% of the $956 billion goes to 10% of farmers. So there's a lot of there's a lot of politics involved in just even this piece, and then there's the commercial agribusinesses are controlling a lot in here, and then the consumers, that is all this personal gain, right? So this sounds like manna, right? That we're trying to gather and hold it, and then not only does it go bad, but it like has all these other effects when it does. And so it's by that learning not to be graspy and greedy with it that we're going to be able to reduce this waste all back along the chain, but including starting with us too, right? So modern manna. And so maybe that it is the dancing serpent with toast that's going to lead us on our way in thinking about food waste. Oh, and I'll tell you one more really cool example. So I've been hearing lots of great examples of what's going on. And there's lots of room for innovation. There's some really innovative chefs, like you were mentioning, that are working on this. And then there's a couple distilleries that are realizing, oh, like leftover cakes and bagels and donuts are actually carbohydrate sources. So they're making vodkas out of leftover bread products. Because it's just the sugars that are needed. Yeah. And there's one called Misadventure Vodka that's in San Marcos, California. There's the Perennial in San Francisco, and they have a drink that's called something like Three Ways of Grapefruit, and so they're using the peels to make one of the shrubs, they're using the hulls, the seeds in another part of it, and then the actual juice for part of it, but they're trying to use all the pieces. Or there's Tim Ma, who's at a restaurant in D.C., he's using carrot tops as pesto, and carrot peels, he's frying them and putting them as salad garnish, and then kale stalks, he's braising and frying them. So he's like trying to really think about, wow, what are all the different ways we can use these? And his is this Asian-inspired cooking. So just really kind of, one of the things when my students come into my agriculture and climate class, I tell them, I'm going to say, I don't know. I don't know what we need to do. I don't know what all the effects of this are going to be. We just don't know yet. And it's kind of this way with this too, right? I don't know, but that's a really kind of good thing, because there's a lot of different ways we can tackle this, from the legislation and thinking about the distributors and thinking about us. But we'll have to work on it.
So do your students tend to come into your classes? Are they enthusiastic and want to make change?
Yeah. I have environmental studies students, and most of them are really in there because
they are our hope, aren't they?
Yeah, but we can still work on this too. We're not done yet.
Well,
I'm not done yet. You guys aren't done yet.
Of course not.
So that's what I have to share today. I hope you learned a little bit along the way, and thanks for all the insight you brought me too.
Thank you.